just wanted to remind everybody of our covenant, right? I'm seeing knowing grins and a few faces of confusion, right? We promised if we came in the auditorium, we wouldn't stop talking. So I'm counting on you upholding your end of the covenant tonight. I wanted to just remind you, I didn't anticipate when I began the class that this verse would just almost become like the theme verse for the whole class, but it has kind of ended up being that way. It is the important connecting verse between the Old and New Testament, that really quick, big genealogy that Matthew gives us rather at the front end of his gospel. Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, and the son of Abraham. And then remember what follows that is an expanded version of that genealogy that begins with Abraham and goes through all of the names until we get down to Jesus. Up to now, that's the only part of Matthew 1 that we've talked about. Tonight, I want to push a little further into Matthew 1. We're leaving behind the Old Testament as we search for Jesus on every page, and we're going to spend some time, the rest of our time, looking in the New Testament. And tonight, we're not going to go very far, just, in fact, a couple of chapters into Matthew, and to notice how Matthew is using the Old Testament to tell the story of Jesus as he begins his gospel. And so Matthew opens, as we just noticed, with this genealogy, but what follows in chapters 1 and 2 are 5 episodes that basically will take us from the conception of Jesus to the settling of his family some years later in Nazareth. Including those pieces, there are 5 episodes in Matthew 1 and 2. And to prepare us, I want us to just walk through those and look at them together. So if you look at verse 18, are you in chapter 1? Look at verse 18. There is a story there about Mary's conception, and that's how chapter 1 ends, with telling the story about Mary's conception. That was necessary. Mary is not married, but she is pregnant, and it was scandalous. And so her fiancé needs to have this explained to him, right? You with me? You understand the problem there? And so that's what happens at the end of Matthew chapter 1. Her conception is explained to Joseph, and we find out how she comes to be pregnant. Now, here's the interesting thing. If that's how Matthew 1 ends, with the story of how Mary got pregnant, what would you expect to find at the beginning of chapter 2 if you were just guessing and didn't know? Sorry? Thank you. You would expect, or maybe some interesting pregnancy stories, right? Because that's how we would write. Oh, here's what happened in the 6th month, and here's what family who came to visit, and things like that. Or at the very least, we would be told about the birth, because there is a really fascinating birth story. Luke tells us more about that, but Matthew doesn't. What does he begin with when he gets to chapter 2? After the conception, what's the next thing? Sorry? Yes. He immediately picks up the story of the Magi, and notice he takes half the chapter to tell the story of the Magi while skipping over all the birth altogether. So ladies, I'm guessing you don't like Matthew anymore, right? He just skips over that critical part and he starts talking about the Magi. I made that a little more dramatic than it needed to be because I want to make this point. Matthew's not writing like men write, is he? He's not telling the story the way we would tell the story, because he's not just telling the story of the life of Jesus. He's telling the Bible story. He is contributing a part to the Bible story. And so, in terms of what he's trying to do, this is the next critical piece, which, by the way, interestingly, is a Gentile piece. The Magi are Gentiles. And so right up front in his gospel, and we talk about how Matthew would especially be appealing to the Jews, notice right up front in his gospel, he hits the Jews with the Gentile piece, right? Gentiles are going to be part of this, all right? The next part of the story is about their exit to Egypt. And really, the last three parts I could think could all be put under that umbrella. I'll explain why I separated these in a minute. But beginning in verse 13, Herod's now become a problem. He knows that he's been tricked by the wise men, and so now he's looking for this rival to the throne. And so the angel comes to Joseph and Mary and says, you need to get out of Dodge. And so they go down to Egypt to escape Herod, which brings us to the fourth episode, and that is this awful incident beginning in verse 16 where Herod is unable to find Jesus, and so he just starts killing babies in the vicinity of Nazareth. And then finally, when that threat is over, beginning in verse 19, we're told that Jesus' family returns and that he settles with his family in Nazareth. And by the way, what happens right after that? How does chapter 3 start? Yeah, now we're off to John the Baptist, and we're ready to begin the ministry of Jesus. So notice how quickly the early part of it. We just did 30 years really fast. You realize that? Now we're moving on to his adulthood and to his ministry. So I chose these five sections because in each of them, Matthew is going to point us back to the Old Testament. And he's going to use this prophetic formula that I mentioned to you last week. He's going to take one of these events and he's going to say, this took place to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet. He says that five times in the first two chapters. He keeps taking us back to the Old Testament. And so tonight, I wanted us to spend some time, to spend this class time, looking at how Matthew uses the Old Testament in these five places. Now, I have a confession to make. When I was a young preacher, teaching Matthew for the very first time, I still remember this, I'm beginning my class, never taught the gospel before, and I start looking over these first couple of chapters I'm going to start with, and I noticed the five episodes and the five prophecies, and I thought, this will be super easy, because all I have to do is look at the prophecy Matthew uses, figure out where it is in the Old Testament, and I just have to draw this neat line back to that verse, and I'm done, moving on, right? Does anyone know why that's not as easy as it sounds?
Because sometimes we don't know what actual prophecy is being. I mean, you can't find that actual phrase or the actual words or whatever, and we're not sure what prophet's being referred to.
Yeah, so I started my study with the first one in chapter 1, and I went back to Isaiah where it was supposed to be, and it didn't sound like it was talking about Jesus at all. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a problem. This is going to be way more complicated than I thought it was. And so sometimes when we start trying to draw these nice clean lines between some passage used by a New Testament writer and what's supposed to be that prophecy in the Old Testament, it isn't so neat. And Bible critics go wild with this. Bible critics grab Matthew and they say, you know what? Matthew clearly had no idea what the Old Testament was about. He just went back there and looked for some familiar language or language that would look like it would work. And he just grabbed that and threw it in his gospel and had no idea about context or anything like that. And so they use it to criticize the Bible. I want to say this up front before we go any further. I think that is unthinkable. I just think that cannot be true. It makes utterly no sense at all. If Matthew in any way was meant to appeal to a Jewish audience, and he starts doing sketchy things with the Old Testament, what problem are you going to have? What's that? Yeah, Jews would know he was doing sketchy things. Of all people, the Jews would have recognized, well, that's not what Isaiah was talking about. That doesn't have anything to do with this. And no Jew would have ever listened to anything that they wouldn't have gotten past Matthew 1 before they dismissed him and dismissed his message. And so I just think it's unthinkable that Matthew is doing something goofy with the Old Testament here. I do think that it's more likely that our understanding of how the Holy Spirit uses the Old Testament in the New has probably been too limited. And there probably is a broader picture of how they do that than we appreciate, which is why I wanted to spend some time here as Matthew adds his piece to the Jesus story and ask you to notice how he's using the Old Testament. Now, when Jeff and I were chatting about this last week, Jeff's question to me was, you're not going to actually cover all of those five prophecies in one class, are you? To which my response was, challenge accepted. I thought about just taking one example and working with that. But I thought that would be inadequate. We wouldn't get the benefit of seeing some of the other ways he uses the Old Testament. So I'm going to say to you several times in the class, this is an interesting place. You ought to dig more deeply than we're going to tonight, all right? I would rather hit on all five of these, if time allows me to do that, than just take one of them. So that's the option I've chosen for, and I am determined to get through all five because Jeff has laid down the challenge. So, yes, sir. Cliff, what do you got?
Yeah, on your previous point, you know, we're reminded that in John 21:25, John told us Jesus did many other things. If every one of them were to be written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have enough room for the books that would be written, right? So it's unreasonable to believe, and God tells us specifically, that he didn't give us every word the prophets ever said, right? So it's not unusual that there might have been times and places where they quoted prophets that didn't get recorded for us in the New Testament, which is fine. God never told us he gave us every word that was ever said by every prophet. So I think that's another piece to think.
And to tag on to that, I think that's such, thank you for that, such an important passage to remember because it reminds us the material that we do have has been especially selected, right? And so we really ought to pay attention to it because the vast majority of things that could have been said weren't written down and saved. Just a special collection of certain things that the Holy Spirit wanted us to have. Like Matthew chapter 1 and verse 18. So I want you to look there. This is the first place where Matthew is going to refer us back to the Old Testament. Just a quick comment on the context. Remember, Matthew is explaining Jesus' conception. This is one of the contributions that he makes to the bigger story. Pay attention to the fact that we have birth drama going on here. Does that ring familiar? I expected y'all to kind of react when I said that. Yeah. Have we encountered birth drama before in the Bible story? Yeah, this is kind of one of those themes that runs throughout the whole story. So we got birth drama here with this one. Well, and again, it's kind of like Isaac. It's an impossible birth, right? Because women who are virgins don't have children. And yet here we have a virgin who's going to have a child. And so the angel has to come and explain all of that. And when the angel does that, Matthew adds this. Now, all of this took place to fulfill what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Behold, the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. Have you heard that one before? That is a familiar prophecy to Bible students about Jesus. And it's taken from Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14. So if you still have a ribbon left in your Bible, drop it in Matthew 1 and head back to Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14. And let's draw that nice clean line between Matthew and Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14. Where the text says, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and shall bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. Now that sounds pretty close, doesn't it? So we have that nice clean line between Matthew and Isaiah. Until we read the context of Isaiah. Hey, so as a young preacher, when I was looking at this, I thought I ought to at least take a little bit of a look at what's going on, and I started reading Isaiah 7, and guess what I found out? Isaiah 7 does not appear to be about Jesus. I know, heresy, right? But read the story yourself. Isaiah 7 is a story about King Ahaz. Let's talk a little about that. Ahaz has a problem. He's got two of his neighbors who are coming together and ganging up on him and threatening him. And so the Lord sends Isaiah and Isaiah's son to go and talk to Ahaz and to say to him, don't worry about your enemies. Because in short order, that threat is going to be gone. I am going to take care of you. I will even give you a sign to prove to you that you're going to be okay and I'm going to take care of you. And Ahaz says, I'm not interested in your sign. He had already made his own arrangements to take care of his problem. He was lining himself up with the bully on the block, the Assyrians. He was going to be okay. He doesn't need God's help. And what's happening in verse 14 is God is saying, I am going to give you a sign anyway. And then he cites this verse. So the question is it this a sign for Ahaz? And if so, what does that have to do with Jesus? And so critics of the Bible grab that and they say, look, clearly he's just yanked this from his context that has nothing to do with Jesus at all. And sometimes we read that and we're kind of left wondering too. So a couple of observations about the mistake I think critics of the Bible make here. First of all, the critic reads just far enough to make his criticism. Would y'all kind of mentally mark that down? Critics read not to figure out and understand. Critics read just far enough to make their criticism. And too often that works with us because we don't read far enough either, right? Secondly, the critic does not recognize, that Isaiah is not writing the history of King Ahaz. What is Isaiah writing? Think about this. Did I lose you with that question? What's he contributing to with this book? He's contributing to the story of the Bible, which is about who? Jesus. That's what the whole class is about, right? Jesus on every page. And what's the point of that? We said in the very first class that the whole story is about Jesus. So guys, we have to remember that when we're wrestling with these pages in the Bible, this is not about Ahaz. His presence here only contributes to the effort Isaiah is making to contribute to the bigger story about Jesus. Now, here's the deal. I said the problem is that the critics don't read far enough, and neither do we. The truth is Isaiah 7 does not stand alone by itself in the book of Isaiah. Chapter 6 goes before it. And guess what comes after chapter 7? Say it loud. Go ahead, Troy. Yeah, 8 and 9 and 10 and 11. Why am I saying that? Because chapter 7 falls in a section. And actually, if you start reading the section, it just becomes clear that there's more going on here. Can I illustrate that for you? If you jump ahead to chapter 8, he says some things about judgment. That's a theme in the prophets. We talked about that last week. Look down to chapter 8 and verse 7. Now, therefore, behold, the Lord is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates. It sounds like a flood, but it's not. Even the king of Assyria and all his glory. This guy you thought you were allied with is about to give you all kinds of trouble. He's going to come like a flood into your land. And it will rise up over all its channels and go over all its banks. Then it will sweep onto Judah and overflow and pass through, even reaching up to the neck. Judgment is coming for you. So that's chapter 8. Look ahead to chapter 9. Because after judgment comes what? We talked about this last week. You're not honoring the covenant, folks. Come on. What happens after judgment? I didn't hear you. Deliverance, restoration, right? That's what follows. That's another message of the prophets. And so in 9, that part of the story picks up. But there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. And those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. And so notice how the fortunes are going to shift. By the way, guess who quotes this part of Isaiah 9 in the New Testament? Matthew, yes. Matthew does. In chapter 4, just a little bit later, he's going to start grabbing some of this restoration language. Then if you look a little later in chapter 9, guess who comes up again? The child. Yeah, look at the child. Look at verse 6. See if this rings familiar to you. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. Who's that about? Oh, I heard it. Yeah, my wife's even whispering. What's up with that? That's not going to work out well if I can't get my own wife to cooperate with me. We immediately recognize that as a prophecy about Jesus. In fact, back in chapter 7, what's the name of the child? Which means God with us. I'm not sure that meant the same thing in Ahaz's day that it meant in Jesus' day, right? I think in Ahaz's day, that literally meant, I'm going to be with you and I'm going to get you through the crisis. But an even bigger fulfillment was coming when Jesus would literally be God with us. In fact, in Isaiah 7 and verse 3, do you remember me mentioning earlier that when God sends Isaiah to Ahaz, he's supposed to take someone with him? Remember that? He's supposed to take his son with him. And his son's name is given. His name is Sher-Jashub. Which means, did y'all see it? A remnant shall return. That's interesting. You go talk to Ahab with your son whose name is a remnant shall return. So all I'm inviting you to consider is that rather than focusing just on verse 14 or a few verses at the first part of chapter 7, you got to take in the whole context here. And clearly, in this larger context, there is all kinds of stuff going on about Jesus. So coming back to 7 and 14, if you look back there, what is Isaiah doing here? What is the point about this child who would be a sign to Ahaz? I'm going to just offer my view of that. I know that there are many, and if we were to unpack them all tonight, that would be our class, okay? So if you want to grab me afterwards and tell me why my view of this is wrong, I'm happy to talk about that with you or to add on to that. Let's do that after class. Let me just show you some of the other ways, or at least one way you can understand this text. There would be a child born at the time of Ahaz. And before that child reaches maturity, the enemies he's worried about would be gone, just as God had said. But I think the point is, just like that, there was going to be another child, an extraordinary child, who's going to come on the scene later, who would also be a sign of God's protection in the most important way over his people, a child who would ultimately sit in David's throne and reign as king. That's part of this larger segment of Isaiah as well. A child that would restore us in the most important way, restore our relationship with God, and a child who would literally be God. You see it? Did that have a connection to Ahaz's time? It did. But the point is, all of that was foreshadowing a much bigger picture that he expounds on as you move through this segment. And so it's kind of like Isaac and Jesus, right? Isaac foreshadowed Jesus who was coming. Does that make sense? Questions about that? Okay, let's press on. Chapter 2 now. When the Magi arrive, King Herod is disturbed. And when Herod was disturbed, everybody was disturbed. They come looking for the child king, and Herod wants to know where he is, right? And so there begins to be a discussion about that with the religious leader. Where is the child, right? And so in chapter 2, and starting in verse 5, they consult the religious leaders who tell them this: the child is to be born in Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what was written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. And so he quotes from Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. So can you find your way back to that place in your Old Testament? Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. And when we get back there, Micah writes, "But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, too little among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth to me to be ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity." Does that sound kind of like the same thing? Guys aren't honoring your end of the covenant. Just thought I would point that out. I think that yes works. Greg, that'll just be terrific. Yeah, it does. It just kind of sounds exactly like what Matthew was saying. I think this one is easier. However, I would say to you that exploring the context is still useful, because he's going to go on to talk about how this coming ruler would shepherd God's people. Does that ring a bell? What did Jesus say about himself in John 10? I am the good shepherd, right? In chapter 5 and verse 5, how he would bring his people peace. And so I actually think Micah 5:2 is one of the easier ones. That is a pretty clear straight line from what the prophet said about this coming Messiah to what Matthew says Jesus fulfilled. Now, let's move on and look at this third one, because this is where it gets interesting again. This is the flight to Egypt. When the Magi stand up Herod and he doesn't figure out where the child king is, he's angry and he's going to start taking out children in the vicinity of Bethlehem and go on this horrible rampage. And so to protect Jesus, the angel tells them to get out of Dodge, and they go down into Egypt. And then the text says, verse 15, he remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. That comes from Hosea 11. So will you now go there in your Old Testament to Hosea 11? This is the prophecy Matthew cites and says it's about Jesus going down into Egypt. I want to read a little bit and then ask you if it sounds like he's talking about Jesus to you. So this is 11 and verse 1. When Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more they called them, the more they went from them. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning incense to idols. Yes, it is I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms, but they did not know that I had healed them. I led them with the cords of man, with the bonds of love, and I became to them as one who lifts the yoke from their jaws, and I bent down and fed them. They will not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria will be their king, because they have refused to return to me. The sword will whirl against their cities and will demolish their gate bars and consume them because of their counsel. So my people are bent on turning from me, though they call on them, the one on high, none at all exalts him. Question. Does that sound like Jesus? Really? Where do you see Jesus? Who rejecting who?
The Jews rejecting Jesus.
The Jews rejecting Jesus. But who is supposed to be the one that gets called out of Egypt? Who's that supposed to be about according to Matthew? Jesus. Does it sound like that? Who does the one in Hosea 11 sound like? It sounds like the children of Israel, especially when he goes on to say, you're not going back to Egypt. Where are you going? Assyria. To Assyria. Yeah, that doesn't sound like Jesus. That sounds like Israel. And the weird thing is, not even good Israel, bad Israel, rebelling against God and being punished for that. And so it does make Matthew's use of this text a little odd, doesn't it? Out of Egypt I call my son. Is it Jesus or is it Israel? And so I hope by now when we encounter places like this where it doesn't quite seem to line up, that your brain says, I need to dig deeper. Maybe there's something else going on here. And I actually think there is something else going on here. I think that the Spirit is using the Old Testament in a little bit different way. I think here at the beginning of Jesus' story, the Spirit wants us to see how his journey is going to parallel Israel's journey. Because remember, Israel's journey began with God calling the nation out of where? Egypt. And that's what he's alluding to in chapter 11 and verse 1. And I think the point is, if you start watching, Jesus' journey is going to look like their journey. Does that sound a little sketchy? Think about it. It may be more familiar than we realize. So remember, they both fled to Egypt, right? Why did Israel go down to Egypt?
Famine,
yeah. They were in danger of dying, and they went there to escape death. Why did Jesus' family take him down to Egypt? Because he was going to die, to escape death. So they're kind of in doubt down there for the same reason. And then later, they both come up back out of Egypt and go back into the land, right? But then think about this. When Israel leads Egypt, they have their own baptism, don't they? What do? Cross through the Red Sea. Well, then in Matthew 3, the next text over, what happens to Jesus? He also is baptized. What happens in Matthew 4?
In the wilderness.
Yes, he goes off into the wilderness in Matthew 4 for how long?
40 days.
That's a nice biblical number again. Well, go back to Israel's story. After they are baptized in the Red Sea, what do? They go off into the wilderness for 40 years. Here's the difference. Both of them go into the wilderness to battle the devil. How did Israel do? They lost. How does Jesus do? He wins, right? What's next in the Israel story after they go through the Red Sea, go through the wilderness to where? Where? Mount Sinai. Thank you. You got to get Sinai in there first, right? Where what happens? They're taught the law of God. Well, what happens in Matthew chapter 5? Jesus goes up on the mountain. And he doesn't have to go up to talk to God. Why? He is God. And so from the mountain, just like God did for Israel, Jesus teaches his people. We could get into the details of that because, frankly, the Beatitudes sort of sound like the Ten Commandments, right? Kind of a prelude to the rest of the sermon. And I like the flow of running down these chapters, but there is another mountain experience for Jesus, right? Where? The Mount of Transfiguration. And who's there? And what does Peter want to build for them? Tabernacles. See all the Old Testament that's in there? I'll throw this one in just because I think it's cool. In Matthew 14 and on one other occasion, Jesus provides bread for his followers when they have nothing to eat. Ring a bell? In the wilderness, God provides bread from heaven to feed his people. And so I'm wondering, here at the beginning, when Matthew grabs that Old Testament passage in Hosea and says, out of Egypt I called my son, could it be that what he's saying is, watch this, watch what I'm going to do here? This story, it's going to follow that story. Yeah, Joel, I saw your hand up. Yeah, it would be kind of fun, wouldn't it, to start exploring all those potential parallels, right? Thank you for that. All I'm saying is they are there and probably more numerous than what I've just cited. What's the point of that? I think that it could be the Holy Spirit is just doing a little something different with the Old Testament here. I don't think he's necessarily saying, hey, this is that. What he said in Hosea, that's this. I think what he's saying is what he said in Hosea is going to be like this. It's going to look like this. We're going to follow the same kind of story. And by the way, that's not unusual to us in this class. That's exactly what we saw in Genesis 22 with the sacrifice of Isaac, right? Why did that awful story take place? Well, it's foreshadowing. It's showing us what Jesus is going to go through. Are you waving at me back there? Okay, I'm going to need you to be nice and loud for me.
God
The last part I'm not completely 100% with you on, because it's all the nation that's called out of Egypt. But I am intrigued by all the potential discussion that we could pursue. Thank you for that, that we could pursue. Do you see it? That's why I said last week that when we just deal on the surface and we don't go back to these places in the Old Testament and unpack them, we're missing some of the richness of what God is doing here. I have to tell you, just the exercise of doing this class has left me even more amazed and more convinced the Bible has to be the work of God. All these connections, when these people are separated by all these time, to be able to knit together this amazing story, how could men do that on their own? I don't think it's possible. All right, where am I at? Ooh, getting close, 9 minutes to go. The last one's quick. So let's look at the fourth one, because it's also kind of a thorny one. When the children are slaughtered back in Matthew 2 by Herod, Matthew adds this prophecy from Jeremiah 31. He says, "Then what had been spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more." Now go back to Jeremiah 31. I would just say that you don't have to go back to Jeremiah 31 where that's found to be confused by that, right? Rachel is who? Not just Jacob's wife, Jacob's good-looking wife. His favored wife. And so, do we even have a place in that story where Rachel's crying for her kids? I don't think I've ever even read that story. So I don't even understand what's going on just with what we have in Matthew, much less trying to go back and grab that in the book of Jeremiah. So I think generally folks are kind of confused by this. And hopefully by now, when we're confused, it means we need to do what? Read more, right? That's exactly right. We need to do more reading. So back in Jeremiah, where this story comes from, need a little work with the context here. One thing that will be helpful in setting this up, Jeremiah 40 and verse 1 identifies Ramah as a gathering place for people going into captivity, okay? And so the figure here actually is really touching. As they gather the people at Ramah to ship them off into captivity, there's this image the prophet gives of Rachel weeping over her children. I think Rachel there is meant to be a symbol for the mother of the nation, right? It would be sort of like a mom in court whose son is being sent off to jail, weeping over him. That's the picture here. Rachel is weeping. It's communicating the grief of these people being sent off into captivity, right? That's the picture, verse 15. Could you just move one verse ahead? Because in 16, the text says, "Thus says the Lord, restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears." What does that mean? What's he saying? Stop crying, which you're not supposed to say, right? When a mom is crying over her kids, stop crying. Why should she stop crying? "For your work will be rewarded, declares the Lord, and they will return from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future, declares the Lord, and your children will return to their own territory. I've surely heard Ephraim grieving. You have chastised me, and I was chastised like an untrained calf. Bring me back that I may be restored, for you are the Lord my God. And after I have turned back, I repented, and after I was instructed, I smote my thigh. I was ashamed and also humiliated because I bore the reproach of my youth. Is Ephraim my dear son? Is he a delightful child? Indeed, as often as I have spoken against him, I will certainly remember him. Therefore, my heart yearns for him. I will surely have mercy on him. I say, in the context of this one statement about the grief of the people going into captivity, there are now five verses that celebrate the fact that God is going to turn that completely around. Do you see that? God says, I will have mercy. I will remember. There is hope for your people. Your people are going to return. You see it? It's restoration language. God said, I know things look really bad right now, but I'm going to fix this. And so I think Matthew grabs this, the Spirit grabs this as an example of what he's going to do about this situation. It looked pretty bleak when the captives were gathering at Ramah to be shipped away, but God says, don't grieve. I'll do something about this. I will show mercy. And so Matthew drops that right in at this place, because what is God going to do? The same thing. How bad does this situation look? Children have been killed. And the parents of the Messiah have hauled him off out of the country because he's in danger. Boy, is it just worse that kids are involved. All that flooding up in Kerrville was terrible. But man, I got to tell you, I could not look at the picture of those little kids. That was awful. This was a dark, dark hour for Israel. And so, what Matthew does is he grabs those words of Jeremiah the prophet and he said, go back and read this, because this looks really awful right now. Rachel grieving her children, but look at what follows. And that's what God's going to do. What's he going to do? He's going to call his son out of Egypt. And he's going to die on the cross and restore his people back to God. This is going to be like that. You see how he's using that there? Look at this story, because it's going to be your story as well. All right, last one. At the end, when Joseph's family returns and settles in Nazareth, Matthew adds, this was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophets, he shall be called a Nazarene. That sounds easy enough. What's the problem? And the answer is? Nowhere. No prophet ever said he will be called a Nazarene, which, wow, then the critics say, he just made this one up. I think there is actually an interesting change in the language that is helpful with this. You notice that when he references prophets here, he uses the plural. Did you see that? That's different from every other one. In all the other cases, it was, this is what the prophet said. In this case, it is, this is what the prophets say, plural. And so I think the best explanation of what's happening here is that Matthew is giving us the gist of the prophet's message about the coming Messiah. And part of that message is that he would be unremarkable. He would come from a despised place that no one attached special significance or respect to. In fact, we know that's true. Do you remember what happened in John 1? When one of the early followers said, I have found the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth. You remember what the response is? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? If I was being tacky to John tonight, I would say, you know, it's kind of like Arkansas, but John's been sick, so I would not do that to him tonight. But you know, right? You understand that. And I think that's what's going on. Here's what I want you to carry away tonight. Sometimes we struggle with this because our view of how the New Testament writers, the Holy Spirit ultimately, uses Old Testament prophecy is too limited. We think only of, well, I find this here and I got to find that exact passage back there. Sometimes it's a whole lot more complicated, and by the way, a whole lot more deep and meaningful. And to really see it, we got to do more reading. All right, we'll start looking at Jesus in Acts next week.